first argued case this morning is number 21-2253, Fingen LLC against Juniper Networks Incorporated. Mr. Denning.
Thank you, Your Honor. Roger Denning of Fish and Richardson, appellate counsel for Fingen. I plan to focus my argument on the third of the issues presented, which is whether the district court erred in awarding fees that were unrelated to the conduct by Fingen's prior counsel that was the basis for its finding of exceptionality. I plan to submit on the papers our argument that the underlying conduct was not exceptional, unless this court has any questions. In Octane Fitness, the Supreme Court broadened the scope of litigation conduct that may subject a party to fee shifting under Section 285.
Can you just, I'm not quite clear on, because time is limited.
Yes, ma'am.
When you said the issue you want to focus on is, so tell us specifically, because is that involving both patents or just one patent?
Both patents, Your Honor. So we argued that the conduct that the district court found exceptional was not and should not have subjected Fingen to any fee shifting. We also argued
so
in the...
So you are arguing it's not exceptional.
We are, Your Honor. I don't plan to address that
today.
Okay,
what are you addressing here? Okay, tell me what you're addressing here.
Sure. So there was specific conduct that the district court identified as being exceptional with regard to the 494 patent and with regard to the 780 patent. But despite that, the district court awarded fees for the entirety of the litigation relating to the 494 patent and the 780 patent, including fees that predated the conduct that the district court found to be exceptional. And that's what I was planning to address
so
today.
You're essentially arguing we have to, the district court has to kind of more precisely apportion the fees to the specific misconduct.
That's correct, Your Honor. As the Supreme Court said in the Goodyear case, the district court doesn't have to be a green eyeshade accountant in drawing these lines, but there does need to be a connection between the conduct that the court finds exceptional and the fees awarded. This court has said the same in the Munchkin case, where we said the district court must provide a concise but clear explanation of the reasons for its award. And in the Rembrandt case, where
okay, so you're talking about the 494, and
okay.
Is your argument that he should have parsed the damages versus the infringement?
That's right. So Your Honor, please.
Go ahead, finish.
The only conduct that the district court found to be exceptional was the damages case. The damages expert report, which the court daubered it.
Well, you say that, and I guess I hear the words, but in his analysis, he really, it seems to me, my read of it, is he really tied, firstly, damages is obviously tied to infringement. And it was all part of one thing. It's kind of hard to tease it out. I take your point that some of the detailed stuff was in the damages context. But all what he said went awry in the damages context was very much related to the infringement case, which I think he said kept shifting and was unclear, and at the end of the day says it was just completely not frivolous, but you know. So I take your point that damages and infringements are different words and different things, but they're very related. And in this case, I think he put the package together. So tell me why he didn't.
Sure. So on the infringement case, for instance, both sides moved for summary judgment, non-infringement and infringement. The judge granted summary judgment of infringement for all but one claim limitation of claim 10 of the 494 patent. And he said that one should go to trial. He never said that Fingen's infringement case...
Yeah, but when he tells the story of what went down, and if you look at the record, you see what went down, a lot of the confusion and the problems he had with the damages, which I think you're suggesting maybe was okay, or maybe, you know, was related to the confusion as to what the infringing products were. So I think, you know, there might be instances where you can tease out two different theories and say they were completely separate. But do you understand what I'm saying? If you look at the whole record and what went down, the damages stuff, and you're right. I mean, they went to trial on it, and it was based on, but it was very much related. The shifting sand stuff had to do not just exclusively with the damages theory, but the damages theory and how it related to the infringing products.
So Your Honor is correct that the primary problem that the district court had with the damages expert report was that it included as a check on the number the revenue for the SRX gateway products, which was much greater than the revenue for the Sky ATP licenses that people had taken. That's a very different issue than the non-infringement case that Juniper put on at trial, and a very different issue than any of the infringement case presented to the court. There was never an argument that the SRX gateway products don't infringe. And even from the beginning of the case, FinGen had always said SRX gateway together with Sky ATP infringes. SRX gateway by themselves, no. FinGen did not argue.
Didn't you also say, Justin, this is a little different.
Okay.
Moving on to another point.
I also think,
just in another respect, didn't he also say that even though, and he admitted error, and it's hard for judges to do that, let me tell you, but he kind of said, you know, at first I thought this infringement, there might be something to this infringement thing. But by the time we tried it, not only did he think the jury was right in finding no infringement, but he thought that he finally understood what the infringement theory was and how, I don't know what adjective he used to describe it, but how really thin or misleading it was. So why isn't that enough to say that he could stick the infringement stuff into the attorney's fees?
So Your Honor is right. After the trial, he discouraged FinGen from filing a JMAL motion, saying that when he heard counsel for Juniper's closing argument, the scales fell from his eyes, and he understood why Juniper did not infringe. FinGen nevertheless filed a JMAL motion, and in his order denying the JMAL motion, the court never said that the infringement case was without merit. Instead, he said it turned to a battle of the experts, and that was the basis for saying, well, the jury had sufficient evidence to find for Juniper on the infringement issue. Pointedly, never in his fee award, in his order awarding fees, did the district court ever talk about infringement. The only issue he talked about specifically in that fee award is damages. So this court has to determine whether the district court abused his discretion in awarding fees.
So where is that language? Where was I reading? What document was I reading where the district court did discuss infringement, saying that he had kind of been bamboozled and he thought it might have some merit at the beginning by what you just cited, where he said at closing argument, suddenly he realized this was just a complete bogus thing. What piece of paper was that analysis?
That was in an argument after the trial. It was before before FinGen had filed its JMAL motion. I don't have the site because I wasn't planning on covering that, but I can get that for you. Maybe I have it. Give me 1 second. No. I will note, though, that in arguing for fees in the trial, and this is at Appendix 8551, FinGen encouraged the district court to award fees based on the infringement case, and the district court didn't do so. It had the opportunity, Juniper argued for it, and the court didn't include it in either of the two orders, not only the one before the accounting, but the one after the accounting, never included the infringement case.
Okay, before your time runs out, you want to move on to how you think he improperly parsed the 780 patent damages.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. As to the 780 patent, the district court gave three reasons for exceptionality. The first of them, chronologically, was that he felt that FinGen should have dropped the 780 patent altogether after the first summary judgment showdown round. Not only claim 1, but also claim 9. The other two incidents that he cited, incidents by FinGen's prior counsel, why regrettable, they occurred after that date. So,
is it correct, just to make sure I have the facts right,
yes, sir,
that after the summary judgment showdown, that the district court refused to certify for immediate appeal?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct. And the additional conduct came long after that. So even in the district court's order awarding fees on the 780 patent, the order states specifically, FinGen should have dropped the 780 patent after that first round patent showdown. So my position, my argument I'm making to you here, is that the fees for the 780 patent should go back no further than that first patent showdown. That was August 9th, 2018. No fees should be awarded before then because in his order, finding exceptionality.
Do you have a rough number of what percentage of the fees? Because it seems like even if you look at the calendar and what went down, I thought a large portion of the fees were during part of the, you know, the showdown stuff and after. So do you, what general guess do you have as the percentage of what we're fighting about here?
I don't. I haven't looked at that. I know that the case was filed in September of 2017. The showdown was in August of 2018. And then the first trial was in December of 2018. So it was almost a year between the filing of the case and that first showdown.
But the stuff that we have in the record that you say occurred after the showdown thing, that seems to me, I mean, that fees were being incurred during that. It wasn't clear to me what fees, what portion of the fees charge would have come before that.
So if the only action that supports a fee award occurred on August 9th of 2018, everything that came before that, including all of the workup for that first summary judgment round, should not be taxed on the 780 patent, which wasn't even a subject of the of that first round. So we would say that's the first date on which any fees, if there's going to be any fee award on the 780, it should go back no further than August 9th. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'm happy to continue to answer any questions that the court has.
Well, I think we're all right for the moment, but we want to be sure we explore it thoroughly. Let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kagan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jonathan Kagan of Irell and Manella, representing Juniper Networks. Judge Prost, to address your question, the quote that you were referring to, it was a part of the hearing, a statement the judge made at the hearing on the JMALs. And it is in the record at page 7855. And this relates to the 494 patent. And what?
So do you want to address your friend's arguments about the emphasis on the so-called damages portion and why infringement should not have been included in that?
Sure. So for the that relates to the 494 patent. The problem with the damages theory is inherently related to the infringement theory. Because what FinGen tried to do was come up with a new infringement theory on the eve of trial, as the court said. So they're inextricably linked. It wasn't that the damages expert had just miscalculated the numbers. It's that they were trying to shift their infringement theories.
But even if that's so, if they came up with this new infringement thing on the eve of trial, then maybe the attorney's fees related to pursuing that new infringement theory on the eve of trial should be included. But why should the prior infringement theory, whatever it may have been,
be included? So there's a number of reasons for that. Number one, one of the factors that the court can consider under Octane Fitness is the strength of the plaintiff's case and their litigation positions. And as you noted, the court said, I realized at the end, this whole thing was based on smoke and mirrors, is what he said. He said, I was taken in by you. And that's really one of the factors that this court can and should consider. That's on the record. This court said on liability, it was a very weak theory. On damages, it's also a weak theory. But the real problem here is that had they come to grips with their real damages number, what would this case have looked like? And that's one of the things that the court's looking at. And the same thing is true with the 780 patent, by the way. This is a case where millions upon millions of dollars were spent by both sides.
We're not deciding the merits. We're deciding where the exceptionality is so. And I must say the damages theory, even though the damages expert was excluded, we certainly have seen that same theory presented in other cases. So it's hard to understand where the exceptional case lies. For instance, apparently there was no Rule 11 complaint or procedure against counsel that the court criticized, and to know where the line is when we have a hard-fought case from both sides doesn't look that different from a lot of the cases that we see, where there are, let's agree, extreme positions taken on each side, and they need to get sorted out.
So if we're going to focus on the sort of aggressiveness with which the case was handled.
Let's start with that, because that certainly perturbed this judge, this very savvy judge with a lot of experience.
Right. So the problem with the damages theory wasn't the merits of the theory. In other words, the judge didn't say, I don't like your theory, so I'm not going to allow
it. He excluded it on Daubert. It had to have been that he didn't like the theory.
No, he excluded it because it was based on a brand new infringement theory that had never previously been asserted. He did not address the merits of the theory itself, because what they were trying to do was invent a new infringement theory to support a new damages case. That was his problem. And if you read his Daubert order, you'll see, and if you read his order on fees, you'll see that's exactly what he said.
But also, if I could just add, and this is a friendly comment to your side, which is that he didn't just say, Daubert, this damages expert was bogus, you're out, they're getting fees. He also relied on what they did afterwards, which he let them put on a fact-based damages case at trial, and that too proved to be, in his view, I think, quite bogus and quite insubstantiated and I don't know what adjective to use.
He used woefully inadequate were the words he used. And that's correct. That's another example of the conduct that occurred during this litigation. But the litigation conduct went far beyond that. So what the judge said, and we're reviewing this for abusive discretion. What the judge said expressly is these things that I'm putting in this order are not the exclusive examples of bad conduct, for example, that I'm basing this order on. He said, this case, it went all the way through this case. He's a very experienced judge. He said, this permeated the entire case. So he's just providing examples in his order of things that he thinks will, I guess.
But isn't that a problem for you? Isn't that the Achilles heel in your case, which is that he used the word example, and the other side is coming in and saying, well, he gave two examples, and that's not enough. You know, we have to be able to review what he did. So you can't say, this whole case was terrible, and here's one example of what went wrong, and you talk about one little thing. How are we supposed to review that, even under abuse of discretion?
Well, so then the answer, and this goes to what Judge Hughes was asking, at one point, does he have to list every single instance of poor conduct in order for this court to have effective appellate review? I would say no, because it's a highly deferential standard of review, and really all you need to look at when you're looking.
Sure, but there's a line there somewhere, right? Like if what he found, the only thing he found problematic was the damages portion of the case, and that he didn't find the infringement portion problematic, but nevertheless awarded fees for the entire case, I think he would have a problem. And it's hard to tell when the examples he's showing are mostly about damages, although I see how you're trying to connect them up to review that. If we don't have a strict apportionment policy for fees, but there has to be some relation, right?
Right. And I think that's why we pointed to other examples in the record. For example,
the problem is, it seems like he did not, even though those were examples of conduct that could have supported an exceptionality finding, I didn't necessarily find the connection where he used those as examples, but rather you posed them as support.
So, for example, in the section of the J-Mall argument that Judge Pro cited, the judge is clearly saying this whole case is based on smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. You've been wrong from the get-go. And he said they had the shifting sands approach, and that's what they did. They always tried to get to the next day of litigation.
So the fact that he didn't repoint to that statement in his attorney's fees award, in your view, doesn't matter because he's already said on the record that the litigation of this case throughout has been exceptional.
Right. So the scope of his award is clear. He says, by the way, it wasn't the entire case. It was a 9-patent case. We sought fees for all 9 patents. He only awarded fees on 2 of those patents. Including the fact that he denied fees on a patent that we won summary judgment on. So this judge has demonstrated, if you just look at the record, he's careful to separate out the behavior and the patents from where he believes they're exceptional and patents where there's not. He's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Well, I'd also point out in his order, he makes several references to the infringement case.
Yes.
The products and infringing products and the revenue base. Because, as I said earlier, there's an intertwinedness between damages and infringement in terms of if there's any infringing products, you've got to know what the accused products are.
There is, and in a way, it's even stronger with aspects of the 780 patent. Because the 780 patent, the notice issues with regard to infringement actually eliminated any potential for liability with regard to certain products because they had not provided either actual or constructive notice. Patent expired before they brought suit. And they brought it against a product that they called the ATP appliance. There was no possibility of any damages because of the absence of notice. But what they did was they made misrepresentations to the court about that notice to keep the case alive. They put on a witness who said, I provided notice of these patents. He hadn't. We had a tape recording of the conversation that proved he hadn't done that. We had them misrepresent, perhaps inadvertently, case law from this court. We also had Finjen try to walk back concessions they had made. And this is in his order on relating to Arctic Cat and notice. So with the 780 patent in particular, but also with the 494, there is this interrelationship between the damages and the liability issues.
Can I ask you about the 780 patent? Your friend was trying to sort of at least parse a piece of it out, and I think he said the pre-summary judgment work and attorney's fees. But the summary judgment showdown was over a different claim, right? It was over claim one, not claim nine.
Right.
So do you have a guess about what portion of the fees we would be talking about if it was prior to the showdown dealing with claim nine?
I do not have an estimate for
it. Do you suspect it was quite de minimis, or no? Am I just making this up?
I don't. It was not a big part of the overall award, certainly. The 494 patent, as your honors know, that was the one that went to trial, and most of the fees are associated with that. So the fees associated with the 780 are much smaller, and for I think that initial period of time are going to be a small portion of the.
But you're also saying that the failure of notice infected it from the get-go.
Yes, it was of course because we didn't get into this. Into this issue in great detail, but in the briefing, but the ATP appliance, there was no damages claim. There was no claim against it whatsoever because of the failure of notice, and the failure of notice started well before, they were aware of the failure of notice before they filed their case.
Would you focus again on what there is about this case that is exceptional to the point of crossing this barrier, which is very rarely crossed, as you know, within the court for fee shifting.
Okay, so yes, so let me start with the case in general. This is a 9 patent case that was brought.
All right, that's not so unusual. Now, what else?
Okay, of those 9 patents, 6 of them ended up being voluntarily dismissed with prejudice after being asserted.
That's not so unusual. We see that from time to time.
2 of them were lost on summary judgment.
We see that fairly
often. And the one remaining patent, which is the one that went to trial, their damages case was found improper as a matter of law because they're trying to introduce a new theory. So they lost on damages.
From time to time. And shifting.
And in addition, they lost on liability, but they didn't just lose on liability. They lost on liability in the way where the court found that their entire case had been based on smoke and mirrors.
Well, so some infringement was found, was it not?
No, no infringement was found. There was no infringement found at all.
Okay, it just was close enough to go to trial then.
Well, you say it was close enough to go to trial. We never moved for summary judgment on that patent. Because under the court's rules, we were allowed to move on one. We moved on another patent. So when Finjen says our claim survived summary judgment, their claim didn't survive a summary judgment motion that we filed. Their claim just managed to survive their own summary judgment.
Well, you see what's troubling me, that this is, and from the viewpoint of what we see on appeal, an extraordinary action. Fee shifting, we have a hard-fought action. Each side overstated. Each side pressed everything that they could and then withdrew. All of these activities that, for better or for worse, seems to prevail once you get at least into patent litigation. Why does this one occasion attorney's fees? And does it in fact mean that every time counsel misstates, like you pressed that their lawyer didn't quite misstate, but simplified precedent, the Novo precedent, as to what had happened, and that it wasn't totally accurate. We see this sort of inaccuracy. If it's significant, it's generally corrected at the trial. I'm trying to get from there to fee shifting, or are we opening the door that every case, that's why I wondered about Rule 11. If this behavior was so representative, how come there was no objection? Formal objection of that sort.
So a brief answer to that. Rule 11 has some specific requirements. It has to be things that are in writing, put in briefs, et cetera, by the parties. But also, and just to be clear, I want to, you know, be forthright with the court. We had filed a motion for sanctions for bad faith. The court denied that motion. So what the court said is, I do not think their conduct rises to that level of bad faith.
Well, that doesn't help, does it? I mean, it doesn't help the way it finally came out?
Well, I would say this. If the court had found bad faith, it would be easier to sustain exceptionality. But the important point is that the Octane Fitness case said you don't need bad faith. So bad faith is not an element of an exceptionality determination. So this case, essentially, is somewhere between exceptional and bad faith, according to the judge. And he looked at it carefully, and he didn't say the whole case. He said only portions of the case. And so what I would say is, this is not opening the door. This is a review based on abuse of discretion. This is an experienced judge who looked at this case, only found exceptionality with regard to 2 out of 9 patents. And when he did that, he supported it both with findings that there were problems with the liability case, but also problems with the conduct of counsel that the appellate counsel here is not disputing. What they're doing is they're acknowledging those errors, and they're just saying, well, we think that those errors don't rise to the level of exceptionality, but we acknowledge they're wrong. That's a classic discretionary call for the trial court to make.
Now, the real question is, what is the level of exceptionality when you have a hard-fought case with just the same, I'll call them, abuses here that we see, unfortunately, are not that unusual.
Well, again, what I would say is this court found, the district court found, that the case that did not have merit on the infringement side from the beginning. That's what he said. It was smoke and mirrors. He said he found numerous examples of misconduct of counsel that were attempting to mislead. He also threw the damages case out as a matter of law. So this is a case where their strongest patent out of all these 9, the way they litigated it, they couldn't bring a damages case. The judge found the infringement case to be all smoke and mirrors, and he found numerous examples of misconduct along the way. That's for their strongest patent out of the 9. So, I don't know how many, you know, when your honors are reviewing cases, I'm sure you see a lot of things. My suspicion is that's actually not typical. But I could be wrong on that. I don't
Can
think
I
you're opening
you about
the door.
A question? I don't know which cases, if this is Octane, doesn't one of the Supreme Court cases also sort of include in there a standard of it stands out, presumably in the experience of a district
Yes, that's court, that's exactly what the
that
standard is.
It stands out. And so we're reviewing abuse of discretion, including on the factor that this judge has concluded that based on his experience, which in this instance is pretty extensive on this judge, and it stands out in his experience in terms of the cases. Is that the right standard?
Yes. The exact language from Octane Fitness is, quote, we hold then that an exceptional case is simply one that stands out from others with respect to the substantive strength of a party's litigating position, considering both the governing law and the facts of the case.
That would be in the district court's view. I mean, the district court would be saying this case stands up.
Yes, this is clearly a decision that's remanded to the or that's left to the discretion of the district court in the first instance.
Okay. Any more questions for counsel? Any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's make it 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to make sure the record is clear on one point. In the first showdown, the district court granted Finjen's summary judgment motion of infringement with respect to all but one limitation. It said that limitation needs to go to the jury, but all the rest I find are met. So Finjen's infringement case was very strong going to trial. There was only one limitation that the jury had to find met. Ultimately, it didn't. But that's clearly not a case that was an unreasonable infringement case, one that would support fee shifting. Counsel continues to pick and choose comments from the court throughout the litigation. The smoke and mirrors is the one that they love to talk about most. That is from the hearing on the J-Mall. But in the judge's order on that J-Mall, the judge never said that the case was without merit. Instead, the judge said this case came down to a battle of the experts, and Juniper prevailed. That's not an exceptional case. That happens all the time in patent litigation. So that cannot be the basis for an exceptionality determination. Juniper tried to make it one, and they argued in their fees briefing that the weakness of Finjen's infringement case should be a basis for exceptionality. The judge did not include that in his order. The only thing he included was damages. That's the only thing that this court can then review for abuse of discretion, is his statement about the damages on the 494 patent. And we submit in that case, then damages, the fees should not be awarded prior to the granting of that Daubert order, which was in December 3rd, 2018. December 3rd, 2018 is when the fees should be awarded, if at all. On the damages case, I want to make sure that we're clear on one point as well, which is that the damages and the infringement cases were not linked in that regard. All along, Finjen had argued that the combination of SRX Gateway and Sky ATP infringed that combination. And I would reference the court to Appendix 5876, which was the Daubert order, and in which the court says, in its motion for summary judgment, Finjen accused, number one, SRX gateways used in combination with Sky ATP. That had always been Finjen's infringement argument. It wasn't a new argument on the eve of trial. Even in summary judgment, they had argued that combination.
I'm sorry to take your time again, because yes. I just want to make clear if anybody writes if there's an opinion on this.
Yes.
I was careful in what I asked about, because I think I thought that stuff was marked confidential in the appendix, the portion of the Daubert order. Is that no longer, it wasn't in the, is that portion is no longer confidential? Of those, all the parties waived all the markings of confidentiality in the Daubert order? I'm sorry to take your time, but I
don't know the answer to that. I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. In that section, the court was just describing what the parties' positions were. I don't think there's anything on 5876 that is confidential. I apologize if it was and I overlooked that. I don't know the answer to that. But that was always the case. And so in Mr. Arce, the damages expert's analysis, he used the cost-saving methodology, which has been used by many experts with approval of this court, and then he compared that cost savings to the revenue on SRX Gateway as well as Sky ATP. The judge found fault with including the SRX Gateway revenue and said you should only compare it to the Sky ATP. But we submit that that was an error because SRX Gateway was an accused product as well. But at the very least, that damages order from the court did not affect infringement in any way. So two entirely separate issues. The only thing on the 494 that the district court found to be exceptional was the damages case. So at most, the fees should be awarded for the damages case starting on December 3rd of 2018.
When you say the damages case, were those fees in the various documentation going back and forth on the result? Were those fees identified? Were they sorted out? Do we know what the total is?
I don't know the total, Your Honor. I don't know how clearly, for example, Juniper's counsel made their time entries to identify whether it was damages only or whether it related to other issues. I would submit that my point was you shouldn't award any fees before December 3rd of 2018 because that's the first conduct that the district court found to be exceptional. Maybe the fees after December 3rd, 2018 should also be apportioned to include only the fees related to the damages case, which is what the court found to be exceptional. I think that would be appropriate as well, based on the authority from the Supreme Court.
Okay, do you want a final sentence to wrap it up, or we have your position?
I think you have my position, Your Honor.
Any more questions for counsel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Both. The case is taken under submission.
Thank you.